Kia ora, you're listening to Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Koroi Hawkins. Coming up first...
At the moment, what we've found is that the variants have become more transmissible.
Health experts say a new vaccine may be needed to stop a mutating COVID-19 Delta variant in Fiji. There are reports that France has quashed a Chinese project to build the Pacific's largest fish farm on the French Polynesian atoll of Hao.
It's more bad news, unfortunately. But I think what's really important is it's much clearer news.
And a study of adverse climate impacts on tuna migration is tipped to boost Pacific negotiations at COP26 in Glasgow this year. Health experts in and around Fiji are warning if the Delta variant of COVID-19 keeps mutating, a new vaccine may be needed. More than 20,000 people with COVID are in isolation, and the death toll has passed 250 and climbing. Christine Rovoy reports.
The US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has this week placed Fiji on level 4 of its COVID alert due to the growing number of cases in the Pacific nation. Professor Fiona Russell from the University of Melbourne says reports that more people are dying from the virus in Fiji should be a concern. At least 200 people, including a baby, have died due to COVID since April this year. Professor Russell says the mutation of the Delta strain could happen.
That is a characteristic of all viruses, not just the COVID virus. And there's other mutations that have already occurred, such as the Lambda variant. But at the moment, what we've found is that the variants have become more transmissible. We have to keep an eye on that. We need ongoing studies to monitor it. Mm. And it may be that in the future, you know, people in Fiji may need a booster with a different vaccine or something.
New Zealand epidemiologist and University of Otago Professor Michael Baker agrees, saying Fiji is going backwards in its fight against the pandemic.
The situation in Fiji is very worrying. They've really lost control of this epidemic at this point, given, as you say, record numbers over the weekend, its very widespread nature.
Fijian epidemiologist Dr. Donald Wilson says the country is overwhelmed by the pandemic.
The worry is because when the health system becomes overwhelmed, when it cannot any longer take in lots of patients who've got severe disease, then unfortunately, like what has been happening in other countries where doctors have to do the unethical thing of needing to choose who to put on ventilators and who not to.
Despite the Fijian Prime Minister's refusal to enforce a national lockdown, Professor Michael Baker says it's not too late for the government to change its strategy.
It depends on what their overall strategy is. If they want to return to an elimination position, I think they need to act very decisively now. And that actually offers a much better route back to economic recovery than trying to suppress the virus and live with it, which hasn't really worked very well in the past.
Close to 500,000 Fijians, or 83.7% of the target population, have received their first dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine, while just over 150,000, or 25.9%, have got both jabs. Head of Fiji's vaccination task force, Dr. Rachel Devi, says the only good news is the Moderna vaccine now in the country is also effective against the Delta variant, the UK variant, and the Wuhan strain of the virus.
We have important strategies that we're planning right now, and we'll release them very soon in terms of how, when, where we roll this out across the country. This will definitely boost it up, especially right now we weren't vaccinating our pregnant women with the AstraZeneca unless obviously individuals consented. But I know there's quite a lot of build-up in that area now. There's a lot of evidence on safety reasons as well.
Meanwhile, an Australia-based Fijian academic warns Fiji is suffering its worst medical, social and economic crisis since the measles epidemic of 1875, which led to the deaths of a third of the country's population. Professor Wadanasi says this could have been avoided had the government listened to the best medical advice, not just in Fiji, but also from its major partners, New Zealand and Australia.
It appears that France has quashed a Chinese project to build the Pacific's largest fish farm on the French Polynesian atoll, Hao. Last week, the French President Emmanuel Macron dismissed the project as grotesque and described the investors as dubious. And pointedly, he said, you cannot be French one day and Chinese the next. My colleague Walter Zweifel has been following the story and he joins me now. So, Walter, what is this Howe Fish Farm?
Well, the project was formally launched in 2015 by a Chinese company called Tahiti Nui Ocean Foods, which is a subsidiary of a Chinese group Tian Rui. Originally, the project was said to be worth about $1.4 billion, and 3 years ago it was still claimed to be able to employ about 10,000 people. As plans evolved, it was downgraded to an investment worth about $320 million. It was to cover costs for fish cages, storage facilities, accommodation, power and desalination plants, and a fleet of boats, as well as ships to carry frozen fish to Papeete.
And so what happened?
Well, essentially very little happened. In 2018, a supposedly final deal was signed with the French Polynesian government, which agreed to exempt this company from any tax for 30 years on the importation of materials and fuel. It also agreed to several other tax holidays for a period of 10 years after the project had been completed. Yet construction didn't start, despite the government spending up large to provide basic infrastructure.
Now, the French President Emmanuel Macron has called the project grotesque. Is that right?
Well, critics say the plan makes no sense economically or environmentally. The plan was to produce 50,000 tons of fish. To do that, they would have to import food, fish food, from probably South America, and that would generate a lot of problems for the environment.
And what about the claim of dubious investors?
The Tian Rui Group is a huge Chinese company mainly involved in cement production. The head of the fish farm project, Wang Chen, he was honoured in French Polynesia and he was given the Order of Tahiti Nui, so he had some standing in French Polynesian society.
And why did Mr Macron take such a jibe at China?
Well, it seems to tie in with his policy of this Indo-Pacific axis that he wants to build or maintain or strengthen towards any advances of China. The axis goes from Paris via India, Canberra, New Caledonia to French Polynesia. It's a theme that has been recurring in his visits and talks in the region when he was in Australia, New Caledonia, and also again in French Polynesia. So for him, this objection to the project seems to be driven largely by geopolitical considerations. He also then, of course, said that for a small country, it is important to have protection, i.e. for French Polynesia to be under French protection.
It's a massive project that he's now sort of stopped. Has he proposed anything in its place?
Yes, he has. He thinks that there should be this type of French institution built here, which is linked to educate young people. Essentially, it's a military type training program that you would like to have there, keeping in mind that employment or unemployment is an issue. And this project would give some employment for young people in Howe and surrounding islands. And interestingly, of course, would tie in with his militaristic approach to this whole issue of what Howe is.
And what has the reaction been in Tahiti?
The reaction has been conspicuous silence. The French Polynesian government, which has been backing this project, which has ploughed in money into this project, has not come out, said anything. They were contacted by local media. They had no reply. The company itself has not replied either. So there is just silence. Vox pop type comments are sort of mixed. People have been waiting for a long time for this project to go ahead. There were huge expectations that it would generate spin-off on Howe et al. They still hope that it will go ahead. Other people think that it is possibly too late for it to happen. So the reaction has been quite mixed.
Now, apart from the fish farm, Howe has some historical significance in terms of France's nuclear weapons test legacy in the Pacific.
Yes, how was the forward base for the French military when it used Mururoa and Whangataufa Atoll to test its nuclear weapons from the mid-60s until the mid-90s? Now, how, for this purpose, there were military bases there. They also built a very long runway, which is more than 3 kilometres long, and that runway is basically the only one of such length anywhere between Tahiti and South America, or be it the Easter Islands. So it is a significant piece of infrastructure. The idea, of course, was also that you could fly fresh from this runway straight to China. That was part of the original project. However, has the disadvantage that it is still left with remnants from these military days, i.e. they talk about rubbish that could possibly be contaminated, so work has not been completed in cleaning up the atoll for civilian use in that context.
A senior climate advisor with the Pacific Community says a recently released study on climate-induced tuna migration will boost the region's negotiations at COP26 in Glasgow. Released on Friday, the study entitled Warming Waters Threaten Tuna-Dependent Economies in the Pacific was carried out by Conservation International and a consortium of technical agencies. The research found that if global warming continues unabated within 30 years, the tuna catch will likely decline by 20% in the waters of Pacific countries. In this third of a multi-part series, I'm joined by a panel of experts from some of the collaborating organizations. Here they are again introducing themselves.
I'm happy to start. I'm Johan Bell. I'm the Senior Director for Tuna Fisheries at Conservation International.
I'm happy to go next. I'm Coral Cassisi. I'm the Senior Advisor to the Director General of SPC.
Hi, Karoi. My name is Simon Nicol. I am the Principal Fisheries Scientist at the Pacific Community and Team Leader for the Fisheries and Ecosystem Monitoring Program.
Hi, Foster Lava.
Hey, kia ora. Might as well jump in now. I'm Hugh Walton. I am the Chief Technical Advisor for the Oceanic Fisheries Management Project for the Pacific Island Forum Fisheries Agency.
Now, if you missed parts 1 and 2 of this panel, head on over to our website, rnzi.com, click on Pacific Waves and check out our episodes from the 31st of July and the 3rd of August. Picking up from where we left off, I asked the SPC's Coral Pasisi if this latest data just signifies an additional climate change burden on Pacific countries.
Yes, it's more bad news, unfortunately. But I think what's really important is it's much clearer news. And the way in which the whole UNFCCC climate change convention discussions are informed is by having accurate science that is very thorough and has gone through a robust process of consideration. Without that data, without having that evidence, it's very difficult to negotiate an understanding of the exact loss and damage that Pacific countries and islands will sustain as a direct result of climate change. When we have this kind of evidence at hand, it enables the negotiators from the Pacific to argue very strongly within the climate change convention process that this is the amount of damage that is happening in this space on top of all of the other major challenges that we face as countries. And as was articulated by Hugh, being the most vulnerable and having all these impacts without having contributed much to this cause at all puts us in a position to start seeking the necessary resources to help alleviate wherever possible these impacts, whether it's to support countries switch their livelihoods, to build resilience as necessary, but also fundamentally to call on global partners to increase their ambition to meet the actual Paris Agreement targets, because the consequences of not doing that are starting to become very, very clear, both from a financial perspective in the potential losses of economic revenues, but also from a non-financial element as well. Heaps of our culture and tradition is tied, and food security is tied to the ocean and the health of both its oceanic and coastal resources, and both stand to suffer significantly. So we have to be able to articulate exactly what that is going to look like, both in economic and non-economic terms, in order to be able to argue for the resources and the necessary ambition to address that.
Naka, what has the study found about what can be done to prevent or mitigate or help Pacific countries cope with the seemingly inevitable changes to the tuna migration given climate change impacts?
Roy, Johan here. I think the whole purpose of the study was really to answer the question you've just asked, because we think it was very important to be able to identify pathways. You know, this is such an important issue. You know, what can possibly be done about it? And I think based on what Coral has just said, the whole approach to addressing all forms of climate justice, all climate justice issues around the world, is actually to reach that aspirational target of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming by the end of the century. This is a huge climate justice issue. So the first pathway, as Coral has said, is for the world to mobilize, to make the commitments, to have the ambition to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees C. We do have a second pathway, which I think we should also pursue vigorously in case the progress towards 1.5 degrees is not as rapid as it should be. And that is to empower the countries to go and negotiate through the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Convention, because that convention is based on some very, very strong principles: international cooperation, sustainability, and, you know, considering the rights of small developing states. And I think what this paper does is it starts to launch that process. The paper, you know, acknowledges that, look, there's still uncertainty remaining in this modelling. As Simon has said, it's got better and better and better, but we can all point to ways in which the modelling can be improved. And the investments need to be made now to really reduce uncertainty in the modelling so that we can position those countries to go and negotiate internationally in a way where nobody could poke a hole in their argument in the sense that they could say, well, you know, you're not actually using the best modelling. We want to equip them to be able to do the best modelling and to negotiate effectively.
Vinaka, Johan, we'll leave it there for now and come back again tomorrow to hear from more panellists. Tomorrow I ask how Pacific Island nations will get distant water fishing nations to accept this as a climate justice issue. That's Pacific Waves for today. Remember, you can listen to us free on Apple, Spotify, iHeart or any podcast platform. And if you're using Apple, please leave us a rating and review so others can also find us. Aere rā.